Welcome to the KMUD Weekend News. I'm your news director, April Lewis, and I'm glad to be with you for this broadcast. In this episode, we have stories on Eureka downsizing a vacation rental project, this week's sports report, California considering plug-in solar, and the U.S. Congress needing to wield additional authority to bring the Iran conflict to a close. But first, some quick local headlines for this weekend. This is KMUD News. Starting off with a reminder from yesterday. KMUD News would like to remind folks that many inland areas in Mendocino, Humboldt, Del Norte, and Trinity County will see high temperatures ranging from the 90s to even triple digits this weekend. Make a plan and take care of any at-risk neighbors, especially the elderly. In cannabis news, the Department of Cannabis Control is providing notice to the public of its intent to establish regulations that would eliminate requirements to individually tag cannabis plants and establish requirements for group tagging instead. The proposed regulations are intended to simplify compliance for cultivation licensees by reducing labor-intensive tagging and record-keeping requirements. The changes would lower compliance costs, reduce administrative burdens, and decrease environmental waste by reducing the number of single-use plant tags that must be discarded. The complete rulemaking package is available on the DCC's website. In Mendocino County, the Mendocino County Fire Safe Council has wrapped up its fifth year of microgrants, awarding $122,000 to 14 neighborhood fire safe councils, FireWise communities, and fire agencies, working to make Mendocino County safer and more prepared for wildfire. This year's funded projects highlight the creativity and dedication of local groups across the county. They include increasing emergency water supplies for firefighting, upgrading communication equipment, reducing hazardous fuels, hosting hands-on community education events, and improving home hardening and defensible space. This microgrant program was made possible through support from Measure P tax dollars and an additional $40,000 in contributions from the Mendocino County Fire Chiefs Association. Many of the microgrants, which range from $2,000 to $12,500, included substantial in-kind contributions such as volunteer labor, donated materials, and local fundraising efforts, stretching each dollar even further. Fire departments who received microgrants include the Covelo Fire Department, Leggett Fire Protection District, the Round Valley Fire Safe Council, and others. Meanwhile, last year's 2025 microgrant projects have recently wrapped up. To see how local communities turned ideas into action and to view their accomplishments, visit firesafemendocino.org/micro-grants and check out the 2025 story map linked at the bottom of the page. And up next, our main stories. This is KMUD News. Concerns about the impacts of vacation rentals led to a reduction in the number of units proposed in a Eureka project. Daniel Mintz reports.
As in other areas of Humboldt County, Eureka is being careful about allowing vacation rentals in residential neighborhoods, and the city's planning commission has downscaled the number of units in one project. In a June 10th split vote, the commission approved a multi-unit short-term rental, or STR, project at 1102 J Street at the intersection of 11th Street. But due to a majority of commissioners' concerns about neighborhood impacts and displacement of housing, two of the five units in the permit application were designated as long-term rentals. The city requires STR projects without an on-site owner to get permits, and planner Taylor Rayburn said the permit in this case was referred to the commission, quote, due to the abnormal nature of multiple vacation rentals proposed on one site, and community interest in vacation rentals. The proposed units are existing and have been in operation without permits. The applicant, local historic preservation consultant Kathleen Stanton, said the city's permitting process is complex and she's now working to comply with it.
I have two other Airbnbs, one in Arcata and one in the county. And all you have to do is pay your fee and you're good to go. And that's really what I was thinking was going on here with the city of Eureka, which I paid the $1,153 fee. I think Arcata, it's about $260. And I heard back months later from the planning department that they didn't like my floor plan or the site plan. And I just thought it was comments from another department. I didn't realize that it was kind of like an octopus. There's many, many departments involved in this permit. There's finance, there's planning, there's building. So I came from a very ignorant place. And when I got the letter a year later from planning staff that I was not permitted, it came as a really big shock to me. But thankfully, with staff's help, we've been able to work things out, and we're now on the right track tonight to hopefully get officially permitted.
A neighbor accompanying Stanton vouched for the project, but another neighbor advised against it, saying, quote, "I don't believe that taking away places within neighborhoods like this from residents and giving it to tourists is appropriate for the life of the city." A motion was made and seconded to approve the project as recommended by staff, but Commissioner Steve Lazar said the number of units is of concern.
This is a lot of units on one property that we're losing. You know, we're gaining in one way, but losing in another way. I find it troubling that this all came with the new owner. I appreciate the investments that were made in the building, and I'm grateful for that. And I do tend to be swayed when it comes to why vacation rentals can be useful, because they make people invest in buildings and infrastructure. But this is a lot larger volume. This is at least 2 to 3 times larger than what we conventionally see when we're dealing with these matters that come before us when they're more controversial. So I struggle to support this.
Commissioner Deborah Dukes lives in the area and is disappointed the units aren't being used for long-term housing.
I share the same concerns. As I said, I walk around the neighborhood a lot. I live not too far away from there. And I was walking by as all the construction was being done and thinking how wonderful it was that this grand old lady was being fixed up. And I commend you for that. And I saw the multiple mailboxes go up and thinking, great, this is going to be multifamily. I don't have a problem with Airbnb units per se. Having them in residential areas kind of rubs me the wrong way. And I like what Commissioner Lazar suggested about maybe making one of the units, at least, into a long-term rental for some on-site supervision.
Lazar made a counter motion to designate a detached studio as a long-term rental, as well as one of the 4 other units in the site's primary home. That motion was approved in a 3-2 vote. Also at the meeting, the commission affirmed that the city's purchase of a site to be used as a 40-unit emergency shelter conforms with the city's general plan. Located on 2nd and A Streets, the shelter will be operated by the Betty Kwan Chin Foundation. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Here's Ray Hamill with this week's KMUD News Sports Report.
The Humboldt Crabs have come out swinging the bats this summer as they continued to roll with 5 more wins this past week. Hello and welcome to this week's KMUD News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on the high-scoring Crabs in just a moment as we take a look at all of the big local sports stories of the week, including news of a big boost for the Crabs' pitching staff, all the latest American Legion baseball news, why it was a big week for one district Little League team, who has been named South Fork High School's Athletes of the Year, how one College of the Redwoods team is succeeding off the field of competition, and news of where 3-time conference MVP Luke Lemke is taking his talents after graduation. But first up, it was another good week for the Humboldt Crabs, who are enjoying a great start to the summer season as they get set for a crucial week next week. The Crabs swept all five of their games this week, including a three-game weekend sweep over the South Bay Storm. Returning designated hitter Adam Enyart had a monster weekend at the plate, hitting three home runs against the Storm. Enyart, who plays collegiately for Sacramento State, hit two home runs, including a grand slam, in a 21-2 win on Friday night, and would add a third home run in a 15-3 win the following night. The Crabs would complete the sweep with a 12-3 win on Sunday before hosting the Fresno A's in a two-game series on Tuesday and Wednesday, winning 7-0 and 16-7. The Crabs are now 9-0 and have scored double digits in runs in seven of those nine games. The club also got a boost this week with the addition to the roster of 2025 Team Pitcher of the Year, Miles Standish. Standish, a Eureka High graduate, is coming off a very impressive spring at Santa Rosa JC, where he finished 9-0 with an ERA of 1.95 on his way to being named Big 8 Conference Pitcher of the Year. He also was named All-State and Second Team All-American. Standish will be in uniform for Friday night's series opener against the Rockland Stonecutters, but is not expected to make his 2026 debut with the team until next week, when the Crabs travel to Lincoln for a key Pacific Empire League series against the always competitive Potters. The Crabs also play the Stonecutters on Saturday night at 6:30 and on Sunday afternoon at 12:30 before their first road trip of the summer. In local American Legion baseball, meanwhile, it has been an exciting start to the new season for the local teams. On Tuesday, the Northern Humboldt Giants rallied late to edge the Humboldt Eagles 3-2 in 17U action. The Giants, who feature players from Arcata, McKinleyville and Del Norte, improved to 3-0 with the win, and all three of their victories have come by just one run. The Eagles, who dropped to 1-2 with the loss, enjoyed a big performance from Eureka High School's Kyle Giacconi, who pitched 4 1/3 innings of one-hit ball and struck out 10. However, the Giants would have the final say, rallying from a 2-1 deficit with two runs in the bottom of the sixth to pull out the victory. In local Little League baseball, the District Majors Tournament of Champions took place this week at the Arcata and Blue Lake Little League fields. And it was a good week for the Redwood Empire Padres, who defeated the Klamath Trinity Nationals 3-1 in Tuesday night's championship game. The Padres had to hold on late as the Nationals did everything they could to sneak a late victory, loading the bases with one out in the sixth inning to give themselves a chance at a dramatic comeback. But the Padres would get out of the jam to seal the victory. The Tournament of Champions title is the second straight for the team, with 8 of their 12 players having played on both championship teams. It was also a good week for a couple of South Fork High School student-athletes. Seniors Travis T-Bone Way and Aubrey Young were named the Cubs Male and Female Athletes of the Year. Both multi-sports standouts played three sports this year. Young played an important role for the Cubs on their march to a second straight Little Four title on the softball fields this spring, and she also played soccer and basketball. Way, meanwhile, was equally influential for the South Fork boys, playing football, basketball and baseball, and serving as an important team leader in all three sports. Switching gears, one College of the Redwoods team enjoyed an outstanding spring away from the field of competition. Head coach Reed Elmore and the CR track and field team have been busy on the recruiting trail and are bringing on 15 local standouts for 2027. The group of HDN stars includes the fastest athlete in league history, Deacon Hanks of Del Norte. The speedy Warrior senior, who was limited this year because of lingering injuries but is expected back at full strength next year, holds the league record in the 100 meters. His fastest time in the event is 10.57 seconds. He will be joined at CR by this year's league champion in both the 100 and 200 meters, Kavi Bolden of Fortuna. And rounding out another busy week in local sports, it's been a busy but somewhat bittersweet spring for three-time conference MVP Luke Lemke of Arcata. Earlier in the year, Lemke made the decision to continue his playing career on the football fields at Golden West College in Orange County. The multi-sport Tiger star, who was a league MVP in both basketball and football, is opting to play the latter in college and joins a successful program that not only has an excellent reputation for sending players on to Division I programs, programs, but also reached the state championship game in 2025. However, Lemke will miss the 2026 season because of a wrist injury suffered early in his senior basketball season after discovering he will need surgery before taking the field again. Having switched from quarterback to receiver for college, Lemke has been living in Southern California and practicing with his new coaches and teammates all spring. Lemke says he is enjoying life in Orange County and looking forward to playing for the Rustlers in 2027 after recovering from the injury setback. And that's this week's KMUD News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
California is considering allowing on-grid plug-in solar panels. Eileen Alfandari reports.
Bernadette Del Chiaro is a longtime solar energy advocate, now with the Environmental Working Group. She says small plug-in solar devices have the potential to expand the benefit of solar power to renters or others who can't install rooftop solar systems.
You really do just need a small patch of sunlight, a solar panel, you plug it into an inverter, you plug it into an outlet, and it immediately can save you money and power your home.
Del Chiaro testified to a California Assembly Committee hearing on behalf of legislation authored by San Francisco State Senator Scott Wiener. He says his bill would eliminate red tape and prevent utilities from requiring so-called interconnection agreements before consumers can use a plug-in solar panel.
Which will give Californians, particularly renters and people who can't afford upfront costs for rooftop solar, the ability to benefit from solar energy by using a plug-in solar device, which we are seeing in other parts of the world, other parts of the country, are a key way for people to be able to reduce their energy costs and to expand solar energy.
A representative for the San Diego Gas and Electric Utility testified against the legislation, saying there are safety concerns which should best be addressed through a process at the California Public Utilities Commission.
Safety requires visibility, and SB 868 removes it. By restricting utilities' ability to review, register, or even be notified that these devices limit our ability to identify backfeed risks, protect our field crews, and manage already saturated circuits.
Southern California Edison also opposes Wiener's bill. PG&E said at this point it neither supports nor opposes the legislation. But Wiener noted that after adding amendments requiring extra safety measures for the devices, the Electrical Workers Union and firefighters both dropped their previous opposition. And he warned against punting the measure to the Public Utilities Commission, which is notoriously slow in moving on proposals that come before it. Former Richmond City Councilmember Melvin Willis testified in favor of the bill on behalf of ACE, the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment. Willis said he's a renter with utility debt, and he's not alone. An estimated 2.4 million Californians have past due utility bills.
Having access to balcony solar would be a game changer for many Californians, including renters, those who are on fixed income, and working class consumers like myself who are faced with soaring high energy costs.
Californians pay the nation's second highest electricity rates after only Hawaii. Del Chiaro said anyone with a patch of sunlight, whether from a balcony, a porch, or even an open window, could immediately start saving money with a plug-in device.
We estimate that a 400-watt system, which is about the size of this table here, will cover about 14% of a typical renter's apartment annual electricity bill, saving about $250 a year. To give you an example of that, that 400-watt system would be expected to generate about the amount of electricity as a refrigerator uses, along with a modem and a Wi-Fi router.
Smaller devices have a dimension of about 4 feet by 3 feet. Del Chiaro said a larger system, up to the 1,200-watt limit for such a device, could power people's air conditioning.
Enabling families, especially in our hotter regions, to afford to cool their home on increasingly hot days.
Del Chiaro added that she expects the price of the systems, which currently range from $500 to $2,500, would drop once more consumers buy them, resulting in economies of scale. Weiner's bill has passed the state Senate and is working its way through the Assembly. Half a dozen states already have passed legislation legalizing such devices: Utah, Colorado, Virginia, Maryland, Connecticut, and Maine. Many other states are considering similar bills. Overseas, Germany is the leader, with 4 million households currently using plug-in solar devices. I'm Eileen Alfandary for KPFA News.
It's been exactly 1 week since the House passed its version of the War Powers Resolution. But fresh bombing in Iran suggests the conflict is far from over. Lawmakers and legal scholars say Congress may need to wield additional authority if it hopes to bring the conflict to a close. Lauren Schmidt reports.
That's why they enacted the War Powers Resolution. They didn't want presidents to draw us into a war because Congress knew how hard it was to stop it once it starts.
That was military law expert Jeffrey Korn. He says the U.S. Constitution gives Congress, not the president, the authority to authorize the use of military force, except in limited circumstances involving short-term operations or an immediate threat. However, previous administrations have sought to test the limits of that authority, leading to the creation of the War Powers Resolution of 1973, a federal law intended to check a president's power to initiate war.
This all kind of culminates during the Vietnam War in a series of lower court decisions when service members challenged the legality of their orders to go fight in the war. They say Congress hasn't declared war. And the War Powers Resolution was an effort by Congress to say to future presidents and future Congresses that there has to be affirmative authorization to go to war, with one exception: an attack on the United States, its territories, or armed forces, creating a national emergency.
Korn notes that the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran was not launched in response to a direct attack on the United States, and argues that the government has relied on semantics as a form of passive justification for its involvement.
Did you notice they're calling them self-defense operations? The rhetoric of self-defense, we're doing self-defense strikes? That's in order to bolster the claim that this is an inherent presidential power. So the administration is trying to characterize the ongoing conflict as within the president's inherent authority as a bulwark against this resolution. If the War Powers Resolution were being complied with, the war was in violation of that resolution on day one and day two.
Under the War Powers Resolution, even retaliatory or defensive military actions are subject to limits. The law restricts unauthorized military action to 60 days, unless Congress formally declares war. And in the case of the Iran war, that clock expired May 1st, a reality that prompted some Republicans to join Democrats in supporting the War Powers Resolution, aimed at ending hostilities in the Middle East.
They've said not only believe we're beyond the 60 days, but to make it abundantly clear, we have voted by a majority of both houses of Congress to tell the president, you no longer have authority to wage this war. And the president is ignoring it. And that gets to your question. Then what?
To that question of the ongoing power struggle between the executive and legislative branches, another reason the War Powers Resolution was created, Professor Korn looks to history to understand how this conflict could ultimately come to an end.
Bill Clinton, back in 1998, I think, the air war against Serbia went beyond 60 days without any authorization. Barack Obama, the air campaign against Libya in 2011, went beyond 60 days without authorization. What legislature and other things, small deployments to Central America and other operations, they've gone to court. And the courts won't do it. They won't do it for two reasons. Number one, they say that's a problem between president and the Congress. That's what lawyers call a political question. It's not the role of the judiciary. We lack judicially discoverable and manageable standards to figure out whether one side is abusing authority or not. To have standing, you've got to enact a law to stop the president, and then he has to ignore it. That's the point at which your action has been completely nullified. And there are some scholars and justices who say even that's not enough because Congress always has its own remedy for presidential illegality. It's impeachment and removal.
Absent a mechanism to enforce the new resolution, the votes may be viewed by some as largely symbolic, President Trump characterizing them as meaningless. However, North Bay Congressman Jared Huffman disagrees.
You know, it would be easy to look at this and say, well, you know, it has no impact. But look, when you now have each branch of Congress saying that this is not a lawful war, that there is a military authorization of force necessary from Congress for this to proceed, that does count for something. And if nothing else, the president is going to have to ask for that when he asks for more money for this war, because each house has now said, you know, we are reclaiming our authority. So, yeah, he will fight this. He will probably veto something if we can work out our differences and get it to his desk. But it's nevertheless significant, I think, that you've got this strong bipartisan statement. And he's going to be asking for hundreds of millions of dollars more money because this thing is hundreds of billions, rather, because this thing is burning through $2 billion a day. There's no way he gets that without Congress actually authorizing this war. And I don't think we're going to do it.
Professor Korn agrees with the representative, saying the votes still move the needle by signaling congressional intent and giving Congress the opportunity to wield another one of its constitutional powers, the power of the purse.
It deprives the president of the argument that he's got implicit legislative support. He can't make that argument anymore. The next step would be to enact a law cutting off all funding. That's Congress's sledgehammer.
However, the Trump administration has already used two budget reconciliation packages to circumvent Democratic opposition and advance its agenda, and is currently considering a third measure to boost military spending. Still, Congressman Huffman believes that would not be a popular move, even among his Republican colleagues.
There's no way. There's no way they get a third reconciliation bill through, especially when the focus is going to be this war. So I hope they try, because I think that's a conversation we want the country to be having. The more we talk about what's going on right now, without congressional authorization, without any end game, with no idea how the heck we're going to get out of this mess that Trump created for us and the rest of the world, I mean, it deserves our attention. So if they try to do a reconciliation bill, that will make this issue front and center. I think it's an important thing for folks to be talking about heading into the November election, too.
Despite bipartisan support, the War Powers Resolution still faces long odds. The House and the Senate must reconcile their competing versions, and any final measure would likely face a presidential veto, requiring overwhelming support from Congress to override it.
So we have this ridiculous, I think, equation where Congress can endorse a war by a bare majority, but to stop a war, it requires a supermajority to override a presidential veto. I think that's wrong.
For KPFA News, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
That's all for our news broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our rotation of broadcast engineers, Dennis Marr, Katie Phillips, Bianna Federico, Michael McCaskill, Larry Lashley, and Javier Rodriguez. Also thanks to our reporters for this broadcast, Daniel Mintz and Ray Hamill. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening. You can follow us on social media at KMUD News, including Facebook and Instagram. Do you have issues important to you that deserve more attention? Are there stories we're missing or that you're curious about? You can give us a call at 707-923-2605. Or send an email to news@kmod.org. Redwood Community Radio Incorporated is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory, the Tsingkiyone, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to the region. I'm April Lewis. Stay tuned in.